This is the Faith in a Fresh Vibe podcast. I am your host, Ro Hattie, coming at you from Treaty 7 territory in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. This is episode 90, or episode 11, of a serial season called Farewell Evangelicalism. Welcome. Welcome, friends, to one of the last episodes in this serial season called Farewell Evangelicalism. Leave a rating and share this podcast. In this episode, episode 11, I invite two guests to come. And this isn't quite the wrap-up, but it's close. We're going to talk about liberation and belonging. In this serial season called Farewell Evangelicalism, we have spent time along this podcast journey interrogating the malformed roots in the evangelical tradition, trying to expose them for their death-dealing ways. Evangelical theology either marginalizes or others those who don't fit the primary gaze or beliefs of the in-group. It's one that seeks social conditions that primarily enrich themselves at the expense of all others. That's what we've talked about in episodes 1, 2, 3, 4. Now, it's easy to pick on evangelicals because the various traditions boast the highest affiliation rates. That's particularly true in America. But we could lump in various conservative Christian traditions as well. Traditions that are built on systems and beliefs designed to pursue and hold malformed power. And as the saying goes, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Exposing evangelical lies and the magnitude they differ from the teachings of Jesus is critical in this moment because of the widespread and unwavering support conservative Christians are offering to the authoritarian politicians. And in turn, what we're getting is havoc being wreaked on our society, focusing and starting on marginalized people groups. Now, whether it's the embracement of fascism, authoritarian rule, these are words that folks don't want to come alongside and believe in. Oh, that couldn't happen here. But it is. Anti-vax or anti-science health policies, the expansion of Gestapo-esque immigration policing for people with irregular status, warmongering, destroying the economy, unfair tax policy that enriches the already super wealthy at the expense of the poor. There doesn't seem to be any saving grace behind why evangelicals would support this particular regime. That's why the purpose behind this serial season has been to open the door to evangelicals and other conservative Christian members to rethink their faith and potentially leave their death-dealing churches. The question is whether or not your tradition is following the teachings of Jesus as described in the Gospels or not. But sometimes pointing out the obvious doesn't help. It's better to show what life and liberation looks like on the other side. The freedom, the humanity, the justice, and ultimately the love that exists outside of life-taking church traditions. As we wrap this series, we are experiencing the escalation of violence rooted in malformed conservative ideologies and beliefs. Christians ought to relentlessly pursue hope, liberation, and even belonging. Yet these things seem in short supply. After 10 episodes, where could we possibly go? Well, we could have continued down interrogating more malformed pillars that we didn't cover, but I think we've covered enough. So it's time to make a pivot. It's time to articulate the possibilities of what liberation and belonging look like. In this episode, I invite Sarah E. Westfall to come and chat a little bit about belonging and processing out of malformed faith experiences. And then we wrap with my friend Sharifa Stevens. We talk about her book a little bit. And then from the voices of our ancestors and those on the margins, we paint a picture of the possibilities of a good way. Let's begin episode 11, on belonging and liberation. We begin with Sarah E. Westfall naming the lands on which her feet touch.
Some of the early inhabitants of this area were the Miami tribe, as well as the Potawatomi people. I grew up hearing a lot about the Potawatomi because there is a state park not too far from this area, and they have highlighted a lot of the history there. So I kind of was like vaguely familiar with that growing up, but not familiar enough that as a 41-year-old adult that I could have said with confidence this morning, yes, this is it. Yeah, I'm in northeastern Indiana. And so there were actually a lot. We, in my city that we're in, there's like three rivers that feed into it. And so it became, there's like still like remnants of a fort in our downtown area. And so it was a place where there was a lot of movement, of peoples, of commerce, of armies and bases and stuff. So there was a lot of movement in this area.
Our books are Siblings on the Shelf.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe you would have something to say about this longing for belonging. Should we just jump into like big questions about belonging?
Yeah, I'm here for it. Let's dive in.
Our longing for belonging, we don't, and I say we. So when I say we, I'm trying to put it within the context of communities that we might have grown up in. So church communities. I don't know if we think too much about belonging until something weird happens. Have you noticed that?
Yeah. You know, I was, even in writing my book, like I was reflecting a little bit on like when did it start getting complicated? Like
yeah,
when did it start feeling more burdensome rather than this longing that I tell this story of like when I was little, we would lived in this neighborhood. And like if I wanted a friend, I would just run across the grass to like my neighbor's yard. I would knock on their door and say, hey, can Emily come out to play? And it was simple. And I allowed myself the freedom to go find a friend. And didn't have a lot of qualifications for that other than she lived next door, you know? And I think that as we grow older, it just becomes more complicated because it gets so wrapped up in these questions we have as we grow and develop of identity and meaning. And so it just, yeah, it gets weird and hard.
What do you think is the catalyst to push us towards asking deeper questions surrounding belonging?
You know, I don't know if I can answer for all people, but I think for me, it was two things. One is that I had experienced wounds. Like I had experienced feeling like I didn't fit. And so I began to ask some questions and tried for a really long time to fill in those gaps with like achievement and performance and recognition, a moment of atta girl, you know? But that was really hollow. It was really hollow, and it wasn't belonging. It was acceptance, not belonging. And I think the other piece of that for me has been at my like lowest and most grief-filled raw self of experiencing people who came and sat with me anyway, who didn't, like I needed so much so desperately, and to have people come sit down beside me and just be present was a gift in such a way that I began to acknowledge for the first time, I want to continue having that. I want that level of not only me being raw and authentic, with other people, but I also wanted to continue to live in this like communal life that wasn't just, you know, breezing across the surface and saying hi and goodbye, and you ask each other how you're doing and great, fine, and then you go on your way. I didn't want to live on the surface anymore. And so I think it's really, for me, that really shifted or made me aware of these deeper questions that I was carrying within me.
You use the word authentic. And I wonder, when I think of community development and the questions that folks hold, authenticity is one of those that we know the word. I don't know if we know what it means in practice, but it is something that we'll toss around. Yet, it often seems like performance is taking the place of authenticity. And I don't know if stuck is the right word, but I'll use it. We're stuck in performance, and that performance is what governs a lot of communities today. And of course, then the flip side of that is it equates to a lack of authenticity. Do you think that's an accurate portrayal of, and let's pick on churches, that the average contemporary church might be displaying on the surface?
You know, I do think performance, and maybe we could even pair that word or like let it hold hands with behavior or appearances. Maybe that's all kind of wrapped up in performance. But I think it is really common in all sorts of groups that there are certain norms, and that in order to feel a sense of the greater whole, we often sacrifice aspects of who we are in order to be able to kind of walk through the door or to remain. And I think that can certainly be true in churches. I think it can also be true in other like civic organizations or book clubs or small groups or whatever, or even our families, you know, sometimes that there are certain either voiced or not voiced expectations for what it looks like to be a part of this larger group. And either we subtly, slowly, without our even noticing, kind of bend or shift or shape who we are so that we can be part of that greater whole, or we're stuck with this like persistent feeling that we are like outsiders looking in, like almost in, but not quite. And I don't have I have a lot of questions surrounding this, but I do wonder how the current like church American, and you can tell me whether this is true in Canada as well, but the kind of model of what the church looks like right now and how much there is produced and, you know, lights, camera, and all these things, like how is that also shaping then the people who are gathering and walking through the door, and that our communal faith experiences like fit this certain format and way. And I have questions about that. And I have questions how that affects then our belonging and the people who walk through the door, whether that's truly welcoming, and if so, for how long, to what extent.
I'm not sure if we're curious enough about our own belonging to make a really hard step of leaving what pieces of belonging we have. I don't know if that's fear, and if it is it makes a lot of sense to be to fear that. As you can tell, mulling over what are these pieces that will compel people to find those deeper aspects of belonging, vulnerability, authenticity, and community. Because from the outside looking in, I see a lot of churches struggling with authenticity, vulnerability. They're the consumer variety, and they seem to be doing okay.
Oh, gosh, I'm trying to remember who said it. I think it might have been Justin Whitmo early in his book, The Common Rule, which was several years ago now that I've read it, but essentially said something along the lines of like, he's talking about like solitude and being quiet, and that we don't like that. We don't like moments of pausing and introspection and reflection because of what we're we're gonna see. And I really remember relating hard to that in that moment, because both to the pace of my own life and how easily it can just kind of snowball away from me, but also how uncomfortable it can be to really look inward and to be honest about not only just naming the emotion that we are feeling. Like, that's step one, right? Of being able to have a name for that, but then peeling back the layers of what is beneath this thing, you know, what might masquerade as as loneliness, or what we might feel as loneliness is we might feel that as lack. We might feel that as a really painful ache, but what is beneath that? And but we don't either want to do the hard, because it is hard work, of really looking and naming those things. But we also don't want, we don't take the time. Like I don't feel like there is a high value on living this reflective, attentive life, both to our internal landscape as well as to, I mean, I think other people as well.
I think however brief lockdowns and the pandemic was this ripping the Band-Aid off of that wound where we were not okay. Many of us were not okay in our own heads. And it was only a week or two. And that was a scary place to be. What are some of the skills that we're lacking when it comes to looking inward? You've already mentioned the attentiveness and attunement, slow stillness. That's it. Those are all of them.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, pace of life, the things that we say yes to, all of those things matter. I just finished reading, it's a few years old now, but How to Do Nothing, about resisting the attention economy, by Jenny O'Dell. And in that, she talked so much about like how so often we think we only have two options when it comes to our attentiveness, that we think we either have to escape and like delete all social media from our phones and just, you know, go live like Henry David Thoreau in the woods, or it has to be like this constant like engagement. That engagement looks like just continuing just the scroll kind of thing. But she really kind of introduced a third way of kind of reclaiming our attention. And I think of Mary Oliver's poem, where she talks about, you know, what are you going to do with your one wild and precious life? And I've been thinking about that a lot lately. Like, do I want to give this, give my attentiveness to this screen for hours on end? Or do I want to step outside on my back patio, breathe deep of the fresh air, of look how we have very few leaves left on the trees, and to just have a moment of stillness out on my back patio? Well, I would like right now, like I would absolutely want to be out on my back patio. that's like a no-brainer. And so I think that really paying attention, it's like very meta, but like paying attention to what we're giving our attention to, is maybe a good first step, just kind of taking an inventory of those things. And I also just wonder, I've been thinking a lot also about how this idea that our spiritual life, that the faithful Christian life is going to lead toward some sort of like greatness, that we're going to do this great thing for God. And that's going to be the thing that like fills our life with meaning. And so it's very like, again, performative and kind of like outcome driven, that what if we allowed our lives to actually be kind of small and kind of quiet and create an atmosphere on a pace of life and a small group of people that kind of creates the atmosphere for being able to even know what is going on inside of our hearts and inside of our minds, and to go deeper than with other people. And so I've just been thinking a lot about that, of like, maybe faithfulness, maybe spiritual growth isn't bigger, isn't more. It isn't flashy or even seen most of the time. And I just wonder how much kind of redefining our expectations with those things would give us some freedom to be able to not feel like we have to be constantly doing in order to both find belonging and fit in, but also to achieve some sort of like spiritual milestone or landmark.
What are you missing in that breakneck speed of constantly doing and busy that you would attain in the slowness and stillness, in the pause, in the reflection? Is it really those aspects of pause and slow give you the time to stop and look deeply when you never could otherwise because it's too noisy?
Yeah, I mean, it's that. It makes me think of Parker Palmer's book, A Hidden Wholeness. And he talks about how this, he likens the soul to this like wild creature, that in order to really to see it, to like give it a sense of safety so that it will peek out of the woods and from behind the tree and you can really get a good look at it, that we need to have times where we are incredibly still and to be able then to see and to become familiar with and to listen to the soul, to the spirit, to whatever word you want to put in there. And that happens, that can't happen when we're at like breakneck speed. It just can't, not easily, unless we like fall down and then, you know, we're laying there and say, oh wait, we have a reckoning of some sort.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think it is the like ability to be attentive, but I think it also is wrapped up in finding worth as image bearers of God, that says you are loved right where you are. You are loved when you do nothing, you know, and to say, and to find that all of these things that we're striving for, that it's like that story of the prodigal son, the father who said, everything you is already here. It's already yours. You just had to like come inside, come sit down on the couch. You know, that's not verbatim from the Bible, but
no, it is
my version of it. And so, but it reminds me of that, of like, we don't realize that we are already loved and God is already here when we're moving so quickly. And so I think that is probably the biggest piece of it for me, and linked to my belonging, is that ultimately God is with me. Emmanuel is here. And I do not have to bend or shift or tried to be understood and accepted by other people, that my deepest core belonging is already intact. It is already here.
Fear is such a critical component to the formation of many churches, and it keeps folks in line. It also informs our politics. It informs how we see each other. It others one another. When you think of fear as like this impediment to our belonging, but also how it creates dividing walls to belonging, so how others might belong, what are some of the causes? And maybe it's just like malformed roots. You know, maybe just the church leaders are just shitty people.
You know, I wonder if fear, specifically around belonging, I wonder how much it has increased as we see really challenging conversations happening in real time on the internet. And this, like, we are seeing so much more volatility and dehumanizing and all of this rhetoric that, for the most part, I would say a lot of those people would not say face to face to people. But I wonder how much seeing that then makes us nervous in our like face to face human reaction or interactions to state either our opinions or to reveal aspects of who we are, because we don't know how they'll be received. And we don't know if there's going to be fallout. We don't know if we're going to not be invited to, you know, family Christmas if somebody finds out how I voted. And so I think that so some of it is just that we see so much contentiousness in our everyday life, and sometimes without even seeking it out.
Mm-hmm.
The other thought I had, and I don't think these are related, and I don't think it's a well-formed thought, but I just know how much fear played a part in some of my early spiritual formation.
Yeah, totally.
In terms of like being afraid of hell, and even in my decision making as a young adult, you know, choosing a career or choosing a degree and choosing a career, choosing who to date, I experienced a lot of fear because I had this image of God that if I misstepped, if I made the wrong choice, he was going to be incredibly displeased with me and that it would have some sort of eternal ramification for me. And so I'm thinking about that and how much for, and I'm like a firstborn, high achieving, dutiful daughter in who I am and in my personality. And so that really didn't mix well for me because I wanted so desperately to belong and to do the right thing.
Yeah.
But in that found so much anxiety. So much anxiety. And so I don't know. I don't know what's at the root of that. But I think that fear has certainly been a powerful force and still probably is, not everywhere, but in a lot of places for maybe trying to get certain outcomes. I don't know.
Thank you to Sarah for sharing her thoughts with vulnerability. Her book is The Way of Belonging, Reimagining Who We Are and How We Relate. We're going to switch gears now. My second guest is Sharifa Stevens. You may be familiar with that name. Sharifa has been a guest on this podcast before. We're going to begin her segment on liberation and a little bit about her latest book and how that relates to liberation and justice. But first, we're in for a treat. Sharifa is going to read a poem from her book.
Feeling myself. I'm feeling myself. No, really. My thighs are thicker. My triceps tauter. I'm stronger. I don't let small stuff get to me any longer. These eyes have seen too much glory. These ears have held holy stories. My body is sacred at all times and ages. From the blush of youth to the wisdom of the sages, the time God gave me to spend is a gift, and honey, I intend to use it all. My neck skin is thinner, my hair fraught. I'm older, and though I care about this a lot, I'm proud. Proud that even now, there's an undiscovered version of me waiting to come to be.
My name is Sharifa Stevens. The territory that I inhabit is Kickapoo, Tawakoni, Wichita, and Jumanos, which is the Dallas area of Texas.
When we talk to God, prayers and poems for Black women, I feel like the last time we spoke way back on episode, insert number here, you were like, I'll never write a book.
Wow. That sounds accurate. I knew that wasn't happening. Not a book with my name on it, but here we are.
It's really neat. And having done a coloring book, which is a book of art, creating beautiful art is special. And this book has woven beautiful words, tales, and poems alongside visual art as well to produce a beautiful book. And I cherish beautiful books that have so much thought and care in them. And this book fits that bill.
That's such a lovely assessment. Thank you. I'm really grateful for the care that was put into putting this book together for the artistry of Camila Rue. Her cover art is stunning. And there is more of that art that helps the reader to take a breath, to visualize the prayer. Her interpretations were gorgeous. And also elevated the words that I wrote in a way that was so exciting to me, because I was just like, well, at least one other person gets what I'm saying, and was able to interpret it visually in such a stunning and thoughtful way. So I'm very grateful to Camila for the work that she did.
Can you share in what manner you held both the hope of liberation and calling your folks into wholeness and finding your whole self, and also the prophetic voice of naming what ain't right? How do you hold that tension as a artist and writer?
I come from a people who have been holding that tension for hundreds of years. I can't even say, well, I uniquely hold this tension of hope. Also,
that's a literary device.
Right. So I claim all my inheritances. You know what I'm saying? So this is a book of poems and prayers because I grew up with the benefit of poems and prayers. So I grew up, I'm from the Bronx. I'm from the birthplace of hip hop. And hip hop is poetry. I grew up in programs. If I didn't get it in school, I went to after school programs that taught me poems like Maya Angelou's Still I Rise, Langston Hughes, Life for Me Ain't Been No Crystal Stair, or The Negro Speaks of Rivers. I grew up with poetry there. I grew up with my grandma living with us, and she would get on her knees morning and night with her hymn book and her prayer book. And she would pray and she would sing. I didn't know just the spiritual weight of this practice, but I knew that when she was praying, I was covered. Prayer, and that's just my little microcosm of the story of faith in the Black diaspora. So my folks are from Jamaica, and I'm very much born and raised in America. In these poems and these prayers, there's always that tension present. In hip hop, there's always that tension between what is and what could be. In the prayers of my grandmother, it's always that tension between what is and what could be. In the poets that I read, there was always that fight. And it was a fight against injustice, but it was also a fight for reclaiming and embodying the dignity of a people who had been told incessant lies about their value, their beauty, their intellect. I was reared in the tension, but I also claim the inheritance of the prophets. I claim the inheritance of the psalmists. So I have a spiritual inheritance where I, when I look at the Bible, I also see that tension. Yeah, that tension between what is and what could be.
I've been batting around this idea a little bit more as I process my own legacy, not in terms of a legacy that I leave behind in terms of gains, but how I am a legacy that speaks to the success of my ancestors.
Yes.
Do you ever make that connection in between the work that you have produced, the stories that are out there, and the ancestors who have gone before you to say, aha, aha, you made it?
Yes.
Yeah, you made it.
Isn't that a beautiful reflection? I believe that I have margin. I have choices. That's not a luxury that some of my ancestors had. Just to have the space to contemplate is a gift from my ancestors who survived, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just volition and choice, which should be every human's experience.
Yeah.
It should be. But it wasn't. As a Black woman, the freedom that I have to speak, to read, to write, to dawdle.
Yeah.
To loiter, as it were. It's a kind of rest that my ancestors also got, but they had to be subversive. They had to use subversive means to snatch rest. They did it.
Oof. Snatch rest.
Snatch it. Because even though the law wasn't on the side of a Black woman in repose. It was literally the opposite here. Literally the opposite. So yes, I do think about it, and I feel a sense of longing in one sense, because there's so much of my ancestry that is unknown, and that's so criminal. It's criminal. And there's also a sense where even not knowing them in detail, I know that my existence is their success.
Yes.
Every breath that I draw is in defiance, like Audre Lorde said, you know, we weren't meant to survive.
We're in a world right now where harm is for real, and bodies that have been marginalized are feeling the extra fear of harm and violence onto their personhood, onto their realities. So we can rest there, and we must intercede in this space and time that calls us to do good and to oppose and to resist. But I wonder if you can dream with me of how do we get to the possibilities where everyone can eat a mango with a ladle. A mango so big, it's the size of a toilet seat.
Not a toilet seat.
I don't know why. I don't know why toilet seat's always my like reference. Okay. That it's like four times the size of a banana.
Okay.
I want your perspective, your dreaming of the hope that is to come for our children.
Well, okay. Let me preface this by saying that I'm really working at optimism, really working at it.
Yeah. I feel that.
For our children's sake, that's like the perfect reason to work at it, honestly, for this future generation. I think that in order to go forward, we'll have to go back a bit. That will look like studying the people who lived outside of the pleasure of the government. And again, that means looking at all of my inheritances, whether it's Christians in days past, who, in defiance of majority culture, chose love and radical communion with each other and selflessness. They were legit persecuted for it. Like, not whatever people are calling persecution in the United States right now.
Sure. Same.
People who were so communal that it was uncomfortable for the majority culture.
Yeah. Still is. Yeah.
Uncomfortable and speechless. Because what do you say about people who keep holding all things in common and care for one another, sick or widowed? And like, what are you going to say? These people aren't selfish enough. I don't know. We're looking at my inheritance of civil disobedience that is also ours, right? Where we have Christian tradition that says when the law is unjust, we don't adhere to the law. Christian tradition that also was good at community organization, was good at rallying people and inspiring them for long periods of time to just boycott things, just boycott things that stood in line with indignity or injustice. Just boycott them into bankruptcy.
Amen.
So I think that looking back at how these people sustained one another is going to be key for us. Not just the work and the results, but the practices that kept them committed to one another.
Boy, I don't know if you said the church, but that is a very specific church that has offered pathways of resistance to malformed systems in our midst. And I don't know if contemporary churches know how to do that. We have either never known how or have lost that memory. Yet the possibilities aren't historical in a sense that we can only read books about it, but those teachers are still here.
They're still here. It hasn't been that long ago. And I think that's why these malevolent powers are saying, let's make sure some books don't make it to the shelves or into people's hands.
Sure. Yeah. Too easy.
Part of it. That's never a good sign. But you're right. They're here among us. I think part of the challenge is that some of this connection has to happen in analog fashion. It's not all, not all online. And that's exciting because have we seen the people who own these social media empires?
Yeah.
We need to be able to communicate in analog fashion because I don't think it's far-fetched to see how algorithms can be manipulated, weaponized, and how only certain information can be allowed to get through. And I don't want to completely demonize social media as a tool. It's a tool. And it's a tool that, I mean, it's brought you to me. So, you know, it's brought so many friends into my life, so many wonderful, positive examples into my life. So I'm not trying to demonize it. I'm trying to say that it's capable of being shut down, manipulated. It's just like legacy media, just like all sorts of tools that we use to gather information and gather each other in society.
It's like the tool to find the potential, yet that nitty gritty still needs to intersect with people, the intersection of relationship, of living well together.
Yeah.
What is, put you on the spot as we trail out here. What are the practices of invitation for us to start finding deeper levels of this life-giving community pointing to the possibilities of liberation for all?
They're really yucky. All the yuckiest practices are coming to the fore, so I'm just going to share them.
Why are they yucky?
they're yucky because the depth of relationship and depth of communal ethic is so heavily reliant on interdependence, vulnerability, and honesty, compassion, and commitment.
Icky, compassion.
Right? Compassion is absolutely necessary. Anybody who is anti-compassion or empathy.
Empathy? Blech.
And that's not the icky one. The icky ones for me are interdependence in such an individualistic culture. Interdependence and vulnerability is the absolute icky. Ugh. And also the most rewarding, the most cherished. But in order to be vulnerable, a lot of times you just have to move forward and go first in vulnerable honesty. And that is so scary. I think that's why I'm calling it icky. It's absolutely necessary for any legitimate relationship. And that's between you and God and between you and other people. So it's It's so hard to go first. So I just want to acknowledge that, because sometimes going first means you lead in vulnerability and the person, they don't reciprocate.
Burned.
They don't cover you. They respond in apathy and indifference. And that is such
or
an
harm.
Injurious or harm.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So injurious. So it takes so much courage to do that. But I think we've witnessed what a vapid, placating, mask wearing religiosity results in.
Why? Yikes.
Right? And not, there are people who want that. There are people, there are plenty of people who populate that kind of.
You think they want that? Or do you not?
I don't know why they're there. I don't know why they're there.
Don't know any other way. Might be easier.
I think that that's true. I think some people do want to wear masks. Yes. I'm not going to lie. So there, and there are some people who are.
That's icky.
It is. It is. But I do think that there are people who thrive wearing masks. And I think that there are a lot of people, like you said, who are discipled into that. And so they don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And fear is underneath that. Why are you wearing a mask? Right?
Mm-hmm. Ooh. Ooh. Ooh.
What happens when you're in a relationship that's not dictated by fear?
Oh, I just shuddered a little bit. I just shuddered a little bit because you just glimpsed a little glimmer of how it ought to be. And maybe I shuddered because we're all chasing a taste.
Yes. This is the taste that I long for from God at the utmost, because I was reared in fear. And so to think about how I talk, how I communicate, the frequency, the depth that I communicate with God will differ depending on whether I'm communicating with God through fear or through vulnerability, knowing that God will love and cover me. It's just completely different. And so those two paradigms also exist with us horizontally. And so there's some people who we can only deal with. Well, I don't know if we can only, but we deal with them through a rubric of fear. And so we have to look a certain way. We have to talk a certain way. There are certain subjects that we can't broach. There are struggles that we can never name. And the mask helps us. And then in the relationships that you're talking about, in the liberative relationships with an ethic of communal love and care and compassion, that is, fear is not there. It's like perfect love casts it out or something. It's weird.
Heard. Have I experienced? In glimpses. It's like when you get a taste of that, something in your body just knows.
Yes.
Maybe I'm being too glib on that, and that's an assumption, but the possibility is that your body will affirm good things.
Yeah, your shoulders will relax.
Mm.
Your blood pressure will decrease. You won't have that tension in your forehead.
Your own mask will come down.
Your mask.
And you can be your whole self. Dang. Where are these people?
We could have that. But we got to be those people, right? But we could have that.
Shucks. Uh-huh. And I think, yeah. And for the places in your life where you have that, isn't it just right? Like, it is good.
It's so good. It's like, This is like what it means to have an abundant life and see the goodness of God in the line of living instead of like waiting for death.
Ooh.
To have these experiences.
Dang.
Right?
Like, dang. We all just waiting for death. Whew.
I mean, we're not, but like, most of us aren't, but, or we've been given this sense that that kind of goodness surely can't happen on this side. Why even think about that? Why try?
No, let's not even go there. That's too disconnected and disembodied.
Right.
But it's so true that that if you're just waiting for death, then your normative becomes delivering death-dealing ways.
Yes. Or we've been given this sense that kind of goodness surely can't happen on this side. Why even think about that? Why try?
No, let's not even go there. That's too disconnected and disembodied.
Right.
But it's so true that that if you're just waiting for death, then your normative becomes delivering death-dealing ways.
Yes.
Yes. Gather around, kids, for Sharifa's words of wisdom. And then we'll cue a little white clef here.
That is hilarious. Right. And I know I'm immediately convicted because I'm like, am I living this for my children? Am I?
That wraps episode 11. Thank you to Sarah Westfall and Sharifa Stevens for gracing us with their voice on belonging and liberation. My hope, dear listener, is that you have found components not only in this episode, but in episodes prior that open the door to a wider understanding of your own liberation and vision and dreams to see liberation expand in your neighborhood, city, and beyond. We have navigated through malformed pillars that are propping up evangelical or conservative Christian traditions, the death-dealing traditions. That component's important because right now, as I record, missiles are raining down on Iran and Israel, and there are Christians out there that are excited, gleeful about the prospect of war breaking out. So long as it's black and brown bodies being put on the front lines, we seem to be okay with the notions and theology to support abject violence and ongoing genocide. There's got to be a better way. Dear listeners, the hope for liberation for all, for love, for freedom, for justice, it's out there. Now you just have to find your people who are chasing the same. Bonus episode is coming at you. I've asked all of my guests to echo the question Sharifa answered around what does liberation look like in this moment? And many of them replied. And I put them all together in an episode. That's going to be bonus episode number 12 coming at you. This is Farewell Evangelicalism, a Faith in a Fresh Vibe podcast. My name is Ro Hattie. Daniel Wheat on the outro. Go find Jesse Peters on the intro and Daniel Weed on Spotify. All the guests, most of them have books that you can find and support. I'll catch you on episode 12. Don't forget, leave a review and tell all your friends.